once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach on this Saturday, March 11th, 2017. And we'd love to have you give us a call in here at 254-773-1400. Matter of fact, we had a caller at the end of last hour we couldn't take, so you're welcome to give us a call back again. And what were we talking about? The jobs report.
Growth.
Interesting thing. We're down to 4.7% unemployment. A lot more, not a lot, about 35,000 more jobs were created and people hired last week than was anticipated. And which sounds like a big thing. It isn't. It was a good report. It wasn't a overwhelming report. And there's a lot of indication right now that it's going to take some significant wage growth in order to get more people into the job market.
Well, we're starting to see it, too. And you talked about this in our newsletter.
The 3% growth.
The 3% growth.
In the fourth quarter last year.
But we had a 2.4% productivity gain.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, production gain.
Production gain, not productivity. You're right. Production gain, where the same person creating, working the same job was creating 2.4% more mm-hmm. than the year before, but the pay went up 3%.
So what we want, and you crunch all the numbers together, we've actually had a production, and that's the productivity gain of 1.3%. Now, that's in the fourth quarter, and it's annualized. So it's actually one quarter of that, except for the fact that if you did it for a year, it'd be 1.3.
Right. The underlying issue here is what you were just saying, is that for a long time during the recession, we asked people to do more with less. Mm-hmm. And we had these big productivity gains in the middle of the recession. And then those productivity gains started dropping off and going slightly negative. So hiring was happening at that point. New people were coming in and being trained. Now productivity is coming back up, and the problem is that we're running out of people to fill mm-hmm. the jobs, so we have to pay more to the people that we have already hired so they don't leave. So we start seeing the pay go up, and this is what leads to inflation long term. When we have lots of people employed, there's a lot of competition for hiring, everybody raises wages, even on people that are doing exactly the same thing that they did last year.
The Federal Reserve's going to meet this week, and I don't think there's any – I've not seen anybody who suggests they're not going to raise interest rates 0.25%.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much a given. We could always be wrong on that, but I think it's going to happen.
The point is that the Federal Reserve really isn't raising rates. They're eliminating negative rates. They're not – the rates aren't neutral yet, and once the Federal Reserve rate gets up close to 3% or 3% and above, then they're starting into neutral territory.
What does that mean?
If the Federal Reserve has an artificially low interest rate, it means that the best borrowers, the highest credit rated borrowers, the major corporations, can actually go into the government can actually go into the bond market, the money markets in effect, and borrow money at a rate that is less than inflation. Yeah.
Inflation is about 2%, and they can borrow at about 0.5, which means the bank is paying to loan them money if you count in inflation.
Right. So when we see the rates come up to where they are at or a little above inflation, then you get into what we call neutral territory. Right now, we're still in stimulative territory. The Federal Reserve is still stimulating the economy a little bit. And I think it's very wise for them to start raising rates at this point. A lot of people have said they should have raised them sooner. But here's a big factor.
I think
factor,
they did it appropriately there.
Right. There's a big factor here for any economic geeks or people who want to be economic geeks. There's a big factor going on here that the Federal Reserve is fully aware of and has been discussing. And they've been discussing it in their speeches. And it causes most people's eyes to glaze over. There's two huge
Just like
issues.
Us, actually. When we talk, most people's right. eyes glaze over as well.
One is globalization. In other words, in order to have inflation, American goods and services we have to see a rise in prices without a rise in quality or benefit. We're in this interesting position where an awful lot of what we buy in the United States can be made someplace else. And if it's made someplace else, the American maker of whatever can't raise the price. And if they can't raise the price because they will be undercut, and by that I mean, for example, the local clothing store that's selling a given type of clothing can only raise their prices a little bit before people turn to Amazon to buy the piece of clothing instead of buying it from the local store.
There's a really good whole industry that this approach, I think a lot of people remember not very long ago, just a couple of years ago, there was a bead craze where everybody was doing beadwork. They were going down to different bead shops and buying these beads. And it was kind of like the Dunkin' Donuts craze or the any number of the other crazes that happened, the Snapple craze.
Cabbage Patch Doll craze.
Right. What this was is beads, American sellers suddenly realized that they could buy beads from China at a very, very low price and sell them here at a higher price and make some money. And there were lots of different beads that could be done this way. So people would come in and buy the beads until the Chinese realized that they could sell them online to the public. And they didn't have to sell them to the people that had the retail establishments. They could sell them through Alibaba or through eBay or through Amazon.
Well, they also, a lot of entrepreneurs realized they could order them from China and sell them on eBay or sell them on Amazon.
Right.
And bypass the local store.
And not only that, they could get it shipped directly from China in the process, so that the beads never came into their hands and they never had to purchase the beads until they were paid for
them. This type of activity is going to limit inflation, and it will probably limit it a lot, because unless we get worldwide inflation, the problem in the United States is it can't happen here until it happens everywhere else because we have global trading. Now, here's where it gets sort of interesting. As the Federal Reserve raises interest rates to head off inflation, it will probably cause the dollar to rise because the very, very low interest rates that are offered in if somebody wants to loan money to the Germans, for example, it's way less than 1%. But if our interest rates rise and they can loan it to the United States government for more, they'll start buying dollars, which will cause the dollar to go up in value, which will cause imports to get cheaper.
Right, which means we'll be having more imports, not less imports.
Right.
This is one of those things. This is just, let me throw in this piece. The border adjustment tax or the tariffs on other countries will cause people to buy more dollars, which will cause our dollar value to go up proportional to the tax on the other countries for importing, which means that we can still afford to import and we haven't gotten anywhere in the process.
So it becomes even then more complex. That means if in the United States the demand is there and for something, and we want to make it in the United States, but we can't afford to pay higher wages, or we can't afford to remain competitive without hiring people that they're not there to hire, then we should start to see a surge in orders for robots. And guess what is going on and has been going on since, and this is one of those other things. I don't have the numbers right here in front of me, but I've read it from several sources now. The robot orders for robotics, things that will manufacture something. And when I say robotics, this is not like a guy walk, like a thing that looks like a robot walking around. These are automatic manufacturing devices.
Either arms or...
Right. We've seen manufacturing rise substantially since the beginning of November, since the election. We have really seen manufacturing take off. And it's not because oil has gone up. Oil dropped 9.1% this last week. Where's this manufacturing activity coming from? And the answer is businesses are ordering automated facilities.
Automated facilities. And you said it's not oil. And I would say it is oil to some extent as well. I have some stuff to throw in here. So what you're saying is absolutely correct in that it's a lot more automated. So the manufacturing that's taking place in the oil market is as newly automated as in a lot of the other areas. They're able to, from the same facility, go to three or four different wells with the same machinery and automated machinery at that.
Well, let me explain that. That's been going on, no question. But normally what we've seen oil production is part of, believe it or not, part of industrial production in the United States. It's considered manufacturing. If you drill for oil and you pump the oil out of the ground, or if you pump the oil out of the ground. Well, oil prices dropped 9.1%. We have a glut of oil. And so oil production is falling off. Meanwhile, but our manufacturing product, our manufacturing activity rose.
The reason that, let me, I've got some stories here on this subject, and it will add to what you're saying. Oil production is rising right now in the United States because it has some lag time. So the industrial production that's going on in oil is based on the cutoff of exports that OPEC and Russia agreed to earlier this year. So OPEC says we're cutting exports, which caused the American companies to go back into production. And they can't stop on a dime. If they've begun the process of opening up an oil well and are fracking again, well, the money gets spent at the beginning. The production keeps ramping up for a while after that. After the main investment comes in, now we've got a glut in oil, so the prices are dropping, which means in the next couple of months, you should expect that industrial output in the oil area to drop again. What that does is keep a cap on the oil prices to some extent. It's very profitable these days at $50 a barrel to do a lot of fracking, and in some places at $40 a barrel. So OPEC is losing control of the oil market. That is some of the industrial output, but what we're not seeing, and this goes with what you were just saying, is a huge hiring boom in the oil industry. It's robotics that's doing this. They've, in many cases, they already have the facilities on the ground to increase the production. They're automating them more. And that lag time is, and that money's been spent, the robotics are coming in. And it makes it harder and harder for OPEC and Russia to compete because the more automation we put in there, the less expensive it's going to be for us to get the stuff out of the ground. So I didn't mean to interrupt completely, but that's an area of great import here in that it's capping the oil price and it's more and more happening for exactly the reason that you were saying, which is automation. And I jumped in the middle of, did I wipe out your thought process by jumping in? I'm sorry about that.
Wow, it's just the point is that inflation is not a major threat, I don't think, in our economy right now. And the reason I don't think it's a major threat is we have globalization and we have, within the United States, we have increasing automation and the a big piece of the manufacturing increase that we've seen this year and at the end of last year was, again, and there's a political element to this. If it's going to be harder to get people to work and if we're going to stimulate the economy and we need a lot more things done and if there are not a lot of people that can be hired to do it, the only way to get the job done is to do it with a robot. Now, by the way, you know what the by far and away the largest purchaser nationally of robots in the world is? Like heads and shoulders above everybody else? Make you guess what country?
Besides Japan or?
No, China.
China.
China. China is basically got the pedal to the metal and the throttle against the firewall, whatever analogy you want to use. This is one of the few, you want something that's a little bit scary. It is policy in China. They actually have a policy of automate everything you can automate because of what you mentioned earlier about their demographic issue of not having enough people.
Right.
And they recognize that as they transition people from agricultural manual work into industry, that's working. And that is the source of their average 10% growth per year for a long period of time is when you increase the productivity of that person. But there's a limited number of people left to transition unless they figure out how to go in and put a lot of tractors in a lot of rice paddies, which is hard to automate.
We automate it in the United States, but the way we automate it is more expensive than replacing the people that are doing it in China. So in China, to buy the equipment to automate rice field work is more expensive than just keeping the people on board. This is very similar to, you know, it takes the minimum wage hike for McDonald's to put kiosks in its restaurant, mm-hmm. because as long as the minimum wage is low enough, it costs more to put the machines in. As technology gets better and those machines cost less and less, it's not going to take an outside force of raising minimum wage. It's just going to be the natural thing to do. And by the way, that's the most dangerous thing to China that I see. As those robotic manufacturing facilities come online and start producing the agricultural equipment to replace the rice paddy worker without giving them a new job. Up till now, the rice worker has been leaving agriculture to go to a new job, not because they've been forced out of it, but because they've got a higher pay to do it. And this could be a danger in that you'll have a higher unemployment based on this.
I really don't think that the Chinese are perfectly willing to build empty cities.
Just keep everybody employed.
Yeah. They built one of the largest dams, if not the largest dam in the world, Three Gorges Dam, and they built it mainly with manual labor. And they have a policy.
They can build another wall or two. They're great up there.
Well, matter of fact, we could probably get them to come build the wall here. They've got a lot of experience in building great walls.
I think it would defeat the purpose to import the labor to do the wall to keep the imported labor out somehow.
Well, I mean, if they all came here legally. What better
legally
yet,
import labor to keep right.
We actually figured out how to economically make the wall along the southern border make sense. Because the issue is...
We would hire Mexicans to do it, right?
Right. Well, this is the point. You build the wall on the other side of the border.
Ah.
Now, let me explain. There's a logic to this, folks. A tremendous logic to this. Buying the land in Texas, and that's where it's going to be a real problem because the Rio Grande is real snaky. And you've got to buy land to put the wall up, and you've got to exercise eminent domain. And this is going to take many, many, many years. It's going to be very expensive. There'll be huge chunks of land.
The land on the other side of the border is a lot cheaper than on this side. Right, so if we just buy it over there and put the – you're right. I think this
will
work.
And we don't have the concrete manufacturing capability in the United States to build all that concrete. So we have to import it from Mexico, which would really – again, it defeats the whole purpose.
We wouldn't be importing it from Mexico if the wall is on the other side of the border. Right. Then it would be –
I can see what you're saying here. To put the wall on the Mexican side of the border, and I think this would be the simplest way to do it is give foreign aid to Mexico for the purpose of paying the guards to guard the wall.
Yeah, if we give the foreign aid to Mexico and then the Mexican authorities write the paychecks for everybody that's doing it, that fulfills another promise too, and that Mexico pays for it, even if it's our money that they're using.
And this is the other thing is they could hire all the people who otherwise would be coming across the border looking for a job to guard the wall.
We're being a little bit silly.
No. I'm actually.
Yes, you are.
it's a little silly politically, but economically.
Economically, it makes sense.
You see, the point is, I forgot the name of the company now, but the company in the Southwest that makes like 80% of the concrete in the Southwest is the majority owned by Carlos Slim, and it is a Mexican, CEMEX. That's it, CEMEX. And so if we build the wall, we're going to be paying a Mexican company for the concrete.
CEMEX is the number two. Old Castle's the number one out of Atlanta. But Old Castle with the
I'm talking about in the southwestern United States.
Yeah, southern United States. But yeah, CEMEX is there in Houston. But if we have the infrastructure spending that we expect to see of over $1 trillion coming mm-hmm. up, then all of the available concrete that we have in the United States is going to be accounted for just there, which means we're going to have to import the concrete to build the wall to keep the imports out.
I get – and one of the – for instance, economic reality is economic reality, and even an executive order can't stop it. And let me give you an example. When the executive order went through to build the Keystone Pipeline, the requirement that all the pipes be made from American steel was dropped.
Right.
And there's a really good reason for that, because we don't have the capacity.
We're
already building enough pipeline elsewhere that we can't, you know, and
we'd be nice, but we don't have the capacity. This is why we are looking for other places to import stuff from. And just as a real quick.
We'd have to import some workers to build some new plants, and it would take so long to come up to capacity that the Keystone Pipeline would effectively be killed.
One of the biggest important items here. There's this concept that we've had as a good idea for a long time to be energy independent in the United States. Mm-hmm. It took us a long time to get here, but we're there. We're energy independent.
Sort of.
We still import and export a lot of stuff.
We import a lot of oil.
We import a huge amount of oil, and if you look at our trade deficit, a big chunk of that is oil that we're importing. Just as a side note, most of that oil gets exported again.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why we call it a trade deficit, this is one of those odd things. The oil comes in from Saudi Arabia, for instance. It comes in on these big tankers. We refine it and we send it back. But we don't send as much back as we took in. But we send enough back. But now the prices are all off. So American companies never really held that. They were being paid a contract payment to process the oil. But we still imported a lot of oil and exported a lot of gasoline. So that's trade that took place, even though we're energy independent. And when we look at our trade deficit, we see we imported a lot more oil than we exported gasoline. Because if we're selling some of that gasoline here, or someone else is, because the refinery's at capacity using imported oil, so it's cheaper there than bringing in refined oil from another part of the country. This is something you'll notice if you drive up and down Texas. The closer you get to Houston, the lower the price of gas. The closer you get to West Texas, the lower the price of gas. And then there's all kinds of places in the middle of Texas that the prices can go really high, because the closer you are to the refining facility, the lower the price of the gasoline. It's just a really simple concept. They've got to ship it to you. They got to truck it to the gas station. That costs money. The further they truck it, the more expensive it is, which means if we have imported oil that we are processing for someone else that we're going to send back to them, we're getting paid a good amount of money to do that. Our American companies are getting paid to refine this oil. They then have a lower priced gasoline right here next to this refinery that they can sell, but this is now imported gasoline, even though we're energy independent. And if you really insist on being energy independent, then you should buy only from American companies. Most people don't do that. They do it based on price. Even Walmart, most of the stuff in Walmart is not made in the United States. So all of this is to say that trade in anything, we will never be completely independent unless we completely stop selling or buying anything from anyone else. And that's going to destabilize us. Every aspect of our economy is now global. It has been for a very long time, but it's much more now than it ever has been.
So we need to do some commercials.
Yes.
It's that time. It's 11:30. And right. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. And if you'd like to give us a call in here on the other side of commercials and get us started on something else, we can give us a call 254-773-1400.
And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number remains 254-773-1400. Excuse me. Well, there's another little piece of economic data that came out today. It actually came out on March 9th. And, of course, it's another one of those wonderful bureaucracies. This is one of them that is not called a bureau. This is the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve comes out with a quarterly financial accounts report, which is kind of mind-numbingly boring mostly, but there's a teeny little bit of data in there that is, to me, pretty fascinating, and you may not know it. U.S., the headline, U.S. household net worth reaches record $92.8 trillion. Yes, that's trillion with a T. When we look at the level of federal spending and deficits and debts, and we look at these numbers, and it's really, really scary. When you look at how much – now, this is not corporate net worth.
This is household net worth.
This is households. You take everything a household owns and subtract its debt from that, and you come up with about $93 trillion.
Yeah, this is something – let me throw this in there as a ringer item. When household net worth is measured – it generally includes the corporate net worth. This is one of those no-brainers that is somehow eye-opening because the households of the United States own the corporations United States.
Yeah, there's a lot.
It doesn't include all of the corporate,
right.
But it includes the vast majority of the corporate wealth is indirectly household wealth because they have 401ks and they have investments in the market,
right.
And so on.
But, you know, hopefully the corporations are actually worth more than what the shares they people own them. But that's
right.
Neither here nor
yeah,
there.
Exactly.
The point is that we now have about 6.5 years of disposable income on average per household in the net worth of that household. That's an all-time record. If you go back to the wonderful days that people look back on and say how wonderful it was in the 1980s, it was about 4.6 times. The net worth of the average American household was about 4.6 times their earnings. Now it's 6.5 times their earnings.
That means we have more that we own, and we have more reserves for our earnings.
And this is an even better one. Just before the market descended in 2000, we owned just over six times, our net worth was just over six times annual earnings. In 2007, just before the market collapsed, it was just a little bit below where it is today. So when we say that we've managed to make it to recovery, we're at almost exactly the same level today in terms of multiples of our disposable annual income in net worth that we were in 2007.
Which says something, because in 2007, the household net worth was $66.5 trillion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And now we're at 92.
So in about 10 years.
Right. When we talk about recovery, what we're saying there is that we're almost 50% more in our net worth mm-hmm. than we were 10 years ago, right at the top before the recession.
And that's good news. That is absolutely amazing news. What is equally amazing, in which I think people really don't grasp, and unless they go back and look at the numbers very, very carefully, they don't realize it, is household incomes have also risen almost 50%.
Right, because
since 2007.
Maybe more than that, because we have more years of earnings gathered today than we did then. So the income has actually risen faster than the net worth, which has risen at a 50% over 10 years, which is not all that long or not all that high a rate of return, a 10-year 50% increase means that you would double in about 20 years, and that gives you about a 3.5% rate of return on our net worth from that time period, which is lower than the historic norm, but a lot higher than people thought it was during that time period.
And it's just one of those things that probably won't make the headlines. You won't see in the local headlines that we are now more wealthy than we've ever been at any point in history. We have an average income that's higher than it, after adjustment for inflation than at any point in history. We have a higher standard of living in the United States today than at any point in history. You start down this list of good news.
The income gap that people talked about so much about the lower and middle class people's income not going up and the rich people's income, that's abated and reversed. So a lot of the concerns that pop up at every one of these big recessions that we've had in history, people act like they've never seen it before and like it's a horrible thing. And when people were yelling about it 2 years ago and 3 years ago about the pay difference between rich and poor, we just refer back to history. This is normal in a recovery from a recession. It's not pleasant, but it's normal. It's not unexpected either. It would be more newsworthy in my mind if it hadn't happened. That'd be something we'd be talking about. But it's a lot easier to report it in a microcosm, this little moment in history, as if it's never happened before. Income gaps, pay differentials, all that good stuff. It's not fair, and it isn't.
Okay, let me say.
But the economy tends to smooth that out over time.
Let me say again, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. We do have a telephone number in here. It's 254-773-1400. I want to talk a little bit about that. And here's one of the – about incomes and net worth and so on. Here's one of the issues that we run into pretty regularly and I think is really, really important to understand. If you're looking at retirement, there is a wealth of apparent ignorance, at least according to the several different.
You could just say that about everything. There's a wealth of ignorance, but for retirement specifically, people are actively ignorant here.
Well, there's a big mutual fund company that ran a survey to determine what people understood about retirement and what they didn't understand about retirement. For example, how much money should you have invested for retirement when you retire? What multiple of your last year's income would be a good number? And most people don't have. Most people say 2, 3, 4. It's actually 10.
Yow! Ouch! Yeah.
It's 10 times.
Significantly more than people were thinking.
And you can think, well, okay, well, then how long will you probably live? And this is just an average in the United States. From the day you retire until the day you die, how long will that be on average in the United States? What would you think?
Do you want me to answer what I think people answered or what I would answer?
Oh, you can give us both.
I would say at this point probably 40 years.
Well, actually, the historic average, and it goes up, is 22.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I would think that the average person would answer, somewhere around 15 to 20. Mm-hmm.
So the point is that if you have 10 times what you made last year, the plan is you'll spend less in retirement, not more, and make it 22 years. Actually, you should be able to get a little, you should do a little better than that. And then this is the biggie. And I read some articles recently. The Wall Street Journal went around and asked people about this information. And apparently there are a significant number of self-investors who at this point are 95% invested in the stock market because they want to be able to withdraw a significant amount of money. Yeah, the stock market has averaged over the long period about 7% a year. And they say, okay, and this is this logic that, believe it or not, I heard it a lot years and years ago. If the stock market does 7% a year and you take out 10 and you have multiples of your income, then you run out of money in 22 years and you can take 10% a year.
Well, you better not live forever then.
Well, not only would you not live forever, first off, the stock market has this nasty habit of not following its average. And usually we're trying to talk people into recognizing that in 30 of the last 35 years, the stock market has risen and the average has been 7% a year. Well, that sounds really good. The reality is, if you retired in 2000 and you were invested in an S&P 500 index fund and you didn't take a single penny out, it would only have been a couple of years ago that you would have seen it finally come back to the level it was when you retired.
Well, retired and not taking a single penny out don't often go together.
So if you were taking money out of an S&P 500, let's say you retired in 2000 when everything was just, or 1999 or 2000.
Peachy keen, everything's going to be great forever.
And you were 100% invested in an S&P 500 index fund. And you had been taking out even the recommended relatively low 4% a year, you would have less money today than when you retired, and you wouldn't be taking out 4% anymore. You'd be taking out about 8 or 9, and you'd be looking at the end of your money. That's something that I don't think people take into account. There's two great dangers. One is not investing in equities where there's growth and where the price has risen on average 7%. Two great dangers. Two is putting too much in there. And the last one is thinking that there's some magic number based on your experience in the market, some high percentage rate that you can take out per year. There's sort of a consensus out there that if you have a well-balanced portfolio, well-allocated portfolio, you can take out about 4% a year and not put yourself at great risk and have the option of increasing for inflation down the road. Unfortunately, a lot of people think they can take out a lot more, and a lot of people try to take out more from conservative positions, which is even more dangerous.
This is a psychological issue, but there's a feeling among investors, this is backed up by many studies, that if they're taking a small percentage out every year for their income and they want to go on a big trip, that they should just take it out of their investments because they're not taking enough out to build up the savings the way they would like to. And so they've built up all this investment, so might as well just take a big lump sum out and you know, buy something big with it. But then they don't lower their withdrawal rate. So they don't lower the amount that they're taking out every month, which now you're talking about a higher percentage of the total. And I know this gets into technical stuff, and we're talking about math. But if you were running a business and you had four machines in the business, or we'll say five machines in the business, they're big machines, and you spent a lot of money to put those machines together, and they're producing things that you're selling to make income. If, because you want to make some changes somewhere else or you want to go on vacation, you sell one of those machines, but you don't take less income, you're going to hurt yourself long term. And people, that's still math. But people understand that a lot better. And that's the way that your investment portfolio is. It's a business. And you've got to look at the income producing assets as like a milk cow that either produces milk or you sell it for the meat. Once you sell it for the meat, there's no more milk. If you want the milk, you can't sell it for the meat. And people don't understand that, because when you get into the market, people tend to put their blinders on because they don't understand it. There's lots of numbers, and it's a lot easier to understand if you go to the situations that are income producing that you do know, whether that's carpentry or if you're working at Wilson Art, if you're making laminates and you get rid of all your laminate creating machines, well, you better find something else to make money with, or you're not going to make any money. So anyway, that's my addition to what you're saying there, is that people tend to think they can take more out of their portfolio every year than they should. And then they also think that they can tap it for large amount lump sums. You got to treat it like a business. Don't mistreat the milk cow. And not if you're dependent on the milk cow. All right. So that was my addition.
Well, good. Telephone number in here remains. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, 254-773-1400. We are coasting down at 11:47 to about 13 minutes left in the program. And we've not just been flooded with calls, but we'd love to have your questions or thoughts at this point.
Right. The number in here, one more time, 254-773-1400. I have something I've alluded to in the past, and I'd like to bring up now.
You're going to allude?
It's an illusion.
Is it lewd, whatever it is you're doing?
A luge. It's not lewd. I should be more lewd. Let me take my clothes off and do this.
That's no, that would be lewd. A disclosure.
It's a lewd disclosure. I want to talk about something that is near and dear to everyone's heart. I'm wanting to talk about outgoing long-wave radiation.
What?
Yeah. Not near and dear to most people's hearts.
Outgoing
long-wave
radiation.
Yeah.
we are running out of things to talk about.
No, in fact, this is something.
This sounds about as big as the fact that breaking news: a man jumped over a fence with a backpack on at
the White House.
1600, whatever.
He did not appear to have any dangerous substances on him.
But it's breaking news,
right? Outgoing long wave radiation. Why am I even talking about this? What is this? There is a long term economics fundamental that we have to include in our models going forward, and that has to do with climate. And people have asked why I believe that crazy left-wing stuff
that people call into radio talk shows.
Well, I'm going to take the caller, then we'll get to this subject because it's a little bit bigger than.
All right.
Okay, so caller, you're on the air with the personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, please take the caller. I'm almost out of time.
Hey, God. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. I'll go ahead. I got to think of what I'm going to say, though.
All right. Oh, well, okay. We have a lot of trouble with that, too.
I just wanted to call in before you closed out.
We try to think about what we're going to say after we say it. That way we make more mistakes.
That's been my strategy, but then I've never had a job where I actually had to know what the hell I was doing, so, you know.
I'm really fascinated to know what field you worked in.
Yeah, well, don't put that out.
Okay.
Anyway, I was just listening to your last comments while I was painting the laundry room, and, you know, I'd just like to add a couple things to that. As you know, I retired 3 years ago, and the thing is, you really have to have some good, solid, sound advice, and I thank you guys for doing that for me. But what you don't know about is taxes, and it takes
That's a general truth, sir.
Well, no, it is a truth, but at the same time, you've got so many different income streams all of a sudden, and it's really hard to plan for. And I think you have to be retired about a year and a half or 2 years, maybe two tax seasons, before you really get it down pat, so you know exactly what you're dealing with and what you ought to withhold.
Right. I call that the shakeout cruise of retirement.
Absolutely. Now, the thing is also that in my experience, we started out kind of high withdrawing from investment accounts. After the first year, you know, we a little bit more stabilized, we can see it more clearly, and we reduced that amount. And then the next year, we reduced that amount too, till I think it's just about right. It's probably around 4.5% or something like that, which seems to be the magic figure. But to just jump right into retirement, regardless of what you've got to retire on, what you can count on, what you can't count on, you really need a couple of years to adjust. And my advice would be to do it the way I did it, but as soon as you see fit, take those investment incomes down to where you're absolutely where you should be instead of where you thought you should have been. And that's all I wanted to say.
Well, there's a bias that works against us. I figured out who you are and how old you are, and I'm about the same age, so we us old guys who are retiring at this point or have recently retired have this bias that's built in because we lived in the 1990s when double digit returns in the market were the norm, and we got this impression somehow in our mind that we could take out 8% a year, and I actually saw these numbers back then, take out 8% a year because the long-term return at that point of the Dow Jones Industrial Average was 12% a year because we were at the top of a bubble but didn't know it. We could take out 8% a year, adjust for 3% inflation, and still have a percent left over.
Yeah.
And we really thought we could take out 8% a year. I remember that pitch being presented again and again and again. Take out 8% a year. You can adjust upward 3% a year for inflation, and there's 1% left over. And it's really, really hard to adjust to an environment where a 4% withdrawal rate is about as high as you probably ought to go. You can do 4.5, but you have to be pretty risk tolerant to do it.
Concur, totally.
Okay.
Well, thank you, sir, for the call.
And is this because you were inhaling paint fumes that you decided to call us?
No, it's because I finally had to stand up because my back is about to just absolutely quit functioning. Mm-hmm.
Well, I've got some places that need painted when you're done.
Sounds sign me up. I'm your huckleberry.
We'll only charge you in marbles to come and paint our fence.
Right. That's it.
Wait a minute. When you play marbles, don't you have to bend over? I can't do that.
No. Okay. Right. I got you.
We'll do it on a table. That'll be fine.
Well, thanks for calling.
Thanks for the call.
See, there is somebody listening.
Yes.
And he's inhaling paint fumes at the same time.
Right. It may say something about all of our listeners at the moment. At least we may be inhaling paint fumes. So I'm going to take what I was just talking about.
Long-wave radiation.
Yes. Outgoing long-wave radiation. I am not a proponent of listening to political opinion about science or political opinion about economics. Or political opinion about medicine, for that matter. I would rather look it up myself. So that outgoing long-wave radiation, look it up. Old Baldy across from me, Jeff, takes astrophotography pictures. He spends great numbers of hours outside at night taking pictures of stars and nebula and galaxies long ways away. And we have filters that he puts on his telescope to filter for specific light radiation that is associated with oxygen or with hydrogen or with a lot of the other gases, because we know how they radiate energy that they absorb. That's called outgoing long-wave radiation. When we have satellites looking back at Earth, and we do, we've got a series of them, measuring exactly the same stuff, what we're seeing is that a great deal of infrared, that's basically the heat, is being retained and radiated internally on Earth in the CO2 bands. And that's increasing with the amount of CO2 out there. That's the science that's nuanced and is not a good soundbite politically. There are people that don't believe that we're getting warmer, and unfortunately, it's become political rather than science, where people say it's bad for business, so we don't want to stop it. From an economics point of view, we got to get ahead of it. We got to get our business practices ahead of it. I don't believe in a great deal of government forcefulness to get this done, but in fighting the government movement to regulate, to not believe in the science is a problem. Let's find better ways of doing business so that we can understand the reality going on around us. When we look at the outgoing long-wave radiation, it clearly shows that the heat that we're retaining in our atmosphere is mostly in the CO2 spectrum and also in the methane spectrum. So what that says is that what we are putting out is heating the planet. Something that isn't said very often, but should be said more, is the CO2 emissions in the United States are down. Not based on regulation, but based on better business practices. It's less expensive to do it the right way long term. Economics will solve this problem too. The reason why I'm bringing this up is because as soon as the science becomes political and it's a yes or no based on a political party, we start making decisions economically that might damage us. If it's more profitable to limit the CO2 emissions, not because of carbon credits, I think that's a silly idea, but because it's more profitable because you can reuse that stuff for better things in a factory, then that's the way we stop the kind of climate change that is science-based, not political-based. And I know that, man, that's one of the hottest topics for politics.
Hottest.
Pun not intended, but it's one of the hottest topics for politics is climate change. It shouldn't be a political conversation except as an awareness thing, because we don't want the government over-regulating it. Regulations are needed. We don't want our rivers to light on fire. We don't want acid rain. We don't want big holes in the ozone. Regulation has been a good tool in the past. It's not a good tool if it's crammed down the throat without explanation. It's not that hard when you look at a something that Isaac Newton was looking at. He would have a prism up, and he could look at whether or not the red band was wider or narrower. Doppler came in and said, this is how we can define if something's moving closer or further away, and that's how we look at our weather radars to see if a storm's coming towards us or away from us. This is long-wave radiation. It's the same stuff. This is accepted. It's very clear science. So make decisions on your own research, not on the politics of the moment. The politics of the moment get insane. Stem cell lobbies are still going back and forth when we can produce stem cells from adults. It's not the same political discourse anymore. I'm sorry, I've taken up the last few minutes of the program.
Well, that's all right. That's what you're here for.
All right. Well, if you'd like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail during the weekend and real live people during the week locally at
254-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can get to our webpage at thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can email us directly at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. On our website, we have podcasts, we have philosophy, we have newsletters, and we think it's worth reading. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM.